I suspect that at one time or another, every one of us has engaged in patently irrational behavior. Have you ever wondered why you've done it or how you can prevent doing it in the future? Behavioral economist Dan Ariely tries to answer those questions in his new book, Irrationally Yours, on missing socks, pickup lines, and other existential puzzles. It has illustrations by William Haefeli and reproduces a number of notable entries from Mr. Ariely's advice column on rationality in the Wall Street Journal. Although the concerns his readers write in about are quite varied, the solutions almost always require a little curiosity, a little experimentation, and of course, just a little rationality. It's published by HarperCollins. Dan, welcome back to our show.
Great to be back.
How do you define irrationality? Is it a bad thing always?
Not always a bad thing. For example, giving money to charity, let's say to a radio station that you really like, it's something that is not rational. It doesn't necessarily help you personally, but it's something that makes you feel good and feel that you're doing your obligation. So some irrationalities are just great.
And it seems to me that something that seems irrational to one person might seem totally rational to another.
So sometimes we have cases like this, but the reality is that there are lots of things that we all view as irrational. For example, I often ask people how many people text while driving. Almost everybody.
Totally irrational.
Yes. Nobody says, you know what, I thought about it. I thought how much I don't want to die, how much I don't want to kill other people. How important is text message? I made the cost-benefit analysis, and I decided that that's the right decision.
Now, I recently driving in New York highways, I've seen areas that say rest areas. They now say text areas, rest areas. Do you think that's going to make people act more rationally?
No. So, part of the issue with irrationality is temptation. And we have cell phones, and cell phones are incredibly tempting. And we use them hundreds of times a day. And all of a sudden, there's a period of your life that you're supposed to override this temptation while you're driving. It's really, really hard to do. And every app is trying to get you to check more frequently and more frequently. And they're good at their job.
On another level, one man wrote to you saying that he was concerned that his wife wanted a more expensive wedding ring than he thought was necessary. He thought that she was being irrational. And you replied that there is a difference between irrational behavior and behavior that's difficult to understand.
Yes. So sometimes behavior is really multifaceted and very interesting. And in the case of engagement rings, there is a question of signaling. You get this as a sign of commitment, but you also get it as a sign to declare to other people what maybe your future fiancé, husband, thinks about you. So from that perspective, it doesn't have to be irrational. It could just be that there's an element of decision that we just don't usually think about. And actually, getting these questions have always been interesting because the moment I get the question, I try to think about it a bit more broadly than the way it's phrased and think about what are the principles that underlie this particular case.
Well, letters like that could easily go to a Dear Abby type column, but they're sending it to you, an economist.
Well, first of all, I would hope to be as clever and thoughtful as Dear Abby. But yes, I think that people write me because they want not just to get a specific answer, but they want some kind of reflection of what is the type of this situation and what are the forces involved in here.
Has receiving all these letters about people's behavior affected your thinking about that old economic saying that people are generally rational actors, at least in the marketplace?
No, I never thought. Well, I haven't thought that this was true for years.
But many economists have.
Maybe economists
still do.
Still do. And you know, if you don't leave your office, it's really easy to keep on thinking this way. But the moment you meet people, politicians, people in companies, whatever it is, it's really hard to believe that people are rational.
So that's why behavioral economics has been developed?
Yes. So economics assumes that people are rational, always make the right decisions, and so on. Behavioral economics basically doesn't assume much. We put people in situations, usually in experiments, and we see how they behave. And behavior turns out to be non-rational, and the implications for this are very important, right? So if you think that people are rational, you would say, let's just give people information. They'll always, always, always make the right decision. But For example, texting and driving, it's not that people don't know that it's dangerous. We do it despite the fact that we know it's dangerous. So it means that the solutions need to be very, very different.
You told a man interested in the economics of begging to try it and report back.
Yes. But by the way, this was a very interesting. So somebody had some observation about begging, and he said, how does this work? And this was also interesting for me. So I gave him a challenge to beg in some different ways and measure it. But I also hired an acting student. This was an acting student at BU, and I hired him to beg money and do some experiments. So sometimes readers send me questions, and I become curious, and I try new things that I haven't thought about before.
Well, I've always wondered why I will give to one person but not to the next person. And I suspect there's a certain amount of irrationality in my thinking at that moment.
That's right.
So I'll see somebody's wearing really nice sneakers. I'll say, why would I give money to somebody who has better shoes than I do?
That's right. We look for lots of justifications not to follow it. But here's the thing. So I hired this BU acting student. He was begging for money in different ways. And at some point, another beggar felt sorry for him because he didn't know how to beg. So he came to him. His name is Daniel. And he said, look, Sonny, you don't know how to beg. Let me show you. And that guy was incredibly thoughtful. He said that the way he begs for money is he comes to people and he put his hand up to shake their hand. And he said that when people get that, they have a very hard time not instinctually raising their hand and shaking. And said once they've looked him in the eyes, it's very hard to ignore him. So that beggar had the theory that people try actively to ignore him because if they can pretend he's not there, their emotions don't get evoked and they don't feel obligated to give him money, but he can override that with some interventions.
Well, you talk about looking people in the eyes as being very important. In fact, you cite the toast rule, looking into the eyes of your fellow toasters, or the rule suggests you'll be doomed to have bad sex for 5 years.
If you don't.
Yeah, if you don't look in their eyes. That's you say that's the perfect superstition?
It's a perfect superstition, and I try to spread it around. And it's amazing. It's a superstition. You know, it's not very costly to look at someone in the eyes when you toast. The punishment seems incredibly severe, 5 years of bad sex. And then not only that, but it's really hard to measure. So if you think about good superstitions, good superstitions have a simple rule that other people can observe that it's frightening not to take into because the punishment is severe and hard to measure. Really good superstition, and I'm trying to propagate it to the extent I can.
Well, we talked earlier about the role of rationality in the market, but don't most people rely on superstitions when they're playing the market?
So the question of what do you call superstition, but absolutely people read into patterns that don't exist. So
gamblers do as well.
Gamblers do as well. You know, we all do it when you look at the sky and we'll see clouds. And in 2 minutes, you say, oh, this big cloud is chasing the little cloud. And there have been beautiful experiments that show that you can show people really random pattern on the screen. And very quickly, people create cause-effect relationship for completely random pattern. And the same thing happens in the market. The market has a huge random component. You can argue how big it is, but it's certainly very, very large. But when we see behavior, we have a very hard time understanding randomness. So, for example, in one experiment, we looked at some outcomes. For example, the shares of IBM went up. And to half the people, we said the share of IBM went up because IBM bought some of their stock back. And to the other half, we said the share of IBM went up because IBM sold some of their shares. And it doesn't matter what we said because, oh, that must be a reason. That's really good. So we are so susceptible to looking for a causal story and ignore variance. And we're so good in telling stories that we tell them to ourselves all the time.
And there was a time when I would hear stock market reports where they would say the market went up because there's optimism about this, or went down because there's pessimism about that. We're not hearing that much anymore. Is that because reporters are listening to people like you?
I don't think so. I think that people just got fed up because they realized at some level that this was nonsense. But you know, the temptation to look at a pattern of data and tell a story after the fact is just a fascinating aspect.
Now, one of the other things that we hear a lot about when we're thinking about investing is risk. And you're a proponent of risk, at least in some cases, especially when people go on vacation. Are you as strong for risk when people are investing?
Well, you know, there's a question of how much risk you should take. But yeah, you know, the thing about this risk surveys. I'm sure you've taken some of them, right? And they say, how much risk do you want to take in the market and so on. I think it's such a stupid question.
It depends
question.
On how old you are.
It depends
it?
On how old you are and what they say, what's your risk attitude? This is such a stupid question. It is shocking to me. So let's say you're the kind of person that doesn't like to take much risk. What does that mean? Does that mean that you should live in poverty? You know what? Go and study yoga, take some meditation, take some pills if you have to. But here's the thing. Why do we need to translate your risk attitude into your investment strategy? The fact is that if you're a young person and you hate losing money, nevertheless, it's the right strategy for you. We just need to hide the risk from you so you don't see it all the time.
One of the economics concepts that you feature prominently and seems to fascinate you is loss aversion.
Yes, that's one of the strongest, most interesting element. And this is the idea that we hate losing more than we enjoy gaining. So think about this contrast, right? Imagine that every day you wake up and you look at your portfolio and some days you lose and some days you gain. But the days that you lose make you really, really miserable. And the days that you gain make you a little bit happy. Overall, you could be really miserable, creating a tendency not to invest, not to take any risk.
I've also experienced that in other areas of life. For example, when I realized that I got very upset when a team that I was supporting lost, and it stuck with me way longer than it should have. But when the team won, I felt good, but it didn't last very long at all.
Yeah. And think about this. This fear of losses basically get us to constrain the areas of life that we explore. So you mentioned vacation earlier. Think about it. If you basically don't want to take any risk, where should you go? Go to Florida, right? I mean, what can go bad? I have nothing against Florida, right? You can sit on the beach, you can drink something, perfectly fine vacation. No risk, but how much reward is there? If you decide to take a risk and go somewhere dangerous, difficult, maybe with strange weather, it might not work out.
Well, where you don't speak the language.
That's right. And it might be difficult, but at the same time, it might create really high return. And I think that's one of the things is that we settle too early on solutions. We don't explore enough. We don't try enough different things. And it's true that we can lose from time to time, but in the process of trying to prevent ourselves from losing from time to time, we lose a lot over the long term.
My guest is Dan Ariely, A-R-I-E-L-Y, author of the bestseller Predictably Irrational, now his follow-up Irrationally Yours on missing socks, pickup lines, and other existential problems or puzzles. The book is published by Harper Perennial. Isn't one of the perils of writing an advice column that you have to be honest?
I hope so. I think it's general, not just in columns.
For example, one man wrote to you saying that his marriage felt too comfortable and he asked if it was time to move on. You didn't give him the answer I might have expected.
What would you expect?
Why would you go to a marriage counselor, try to work things out?
I think it's very hard not to look at the facts. And the fact is that marriages are hard to maintain over a long time. And lots of people are unhappy. And the odds that marriage counselors are going to help is not very high. So sometimes the truth is brutal. But the reality is that I thought in that case he should explore other options.
A lot of your observations about irrational behavior is transactional. Things like, is altruism irrational? The Ayn Rand problem. Mm-hmm. Or are there always benefits to good deeds because of enlightened self-interest? Where do you stand on those things? Right now we're in the middle of fundraising, so be careful of what you say.
So the research on the psychology of giving is really very interesting. And it turns out that people mistakenly don't give enough. So imagine the following experiment. You give somebody a gift card to go and buy themselves a cappuccino. And then they go and they buy themselves a cappuccino. You call them in the evening and you say, how happy are you? Those people are not happier because they got themselves a cappuccino. You take another person, you give them a gift card, and you say, please go and give this to a random place to buy themselves a cappuccino. You call these people at the end, the people who gave the cappuccino, and they're happier. Now, those people didn't really even give a cappuccino. They just followed the instructions. They gave the cappuccino from somebody else. But the act of giving actually makes us happier for longer than we think. And then something that people mistakenly don't understand. So I think, there's a question of how come money doesn't buy happiness? And one answer for that is that we don't give enough and we don't give in a smart way.
So Ayn Rand was wrong.
Obviously.
In your introduction, you talk about your experience as a burn victim and how that gives you a particular perspective on life and human behavior. What is that perspective?
So a couple of things happened because I was in hospital for a long time is that people with lots of injuries write me. So you asked me earlier about honesty. Not too long, somebody with a very difficult injury wrote me and wanted me to give him advice about whether to kill himself or not. Now, that's, of course, something I did not answer in the column, but I did call him and we did talk for a long time about that. And I tried to be honest and I told him I don't think it's a bad idea to kill himself. I just said that maybe not yet. And we talked about some experiments he could do in life, some things that he could try out before he gives up that might actually allow him to find some happiness in life. So you know, this injury does a couple of things. I think one is that I just get some very different questions. The other thing is that you can think about an injury as a microscope on life. There's lots of things that I notice because are difficult for me or hard for me or because I'm kind of a little bit outsider to society. And I think to some degree it gives me some improvement in my power of observation.
You answer a lot of concerns about personal finances, but what are your opinions about larger scale economic trends? Were the behaviors of the banks before the 2008 economic crisis irrational? They made a lot of money, although they wound up in some cases paying big fines, but that those fines don't seem to many people to have been any more punitive than just the cost of doing business.
Yeah. So there's lots of things that went wrong in banking system. And of course, many people
I'm just asking, is greed irrational or is it rational in certain instances?
So greed could be rational. But I'll tell you that there were lots of bankers in 2008 that had all the retirement money in the stock of the bank that they were working for. Right, so I actually know some people who were, you know, students at MIT when I was teaching there, and went into banking and were in one of those banks that got collapsed, and they believed that what they were doing was successful. So they had all the retirement money invested in their company, and they lost everything. Now, at the end of the day, some people made fortunes, some people lost fortunes. But it wasn't, people did not truly understand what was going on. You see, to truly be rational, it's not just about the outcome being a good outcome. It's the fact that you understood what was going around and you make a thoughtful decision to get to where you got. And I think in most cases, this is not the case.
Dan Ariely is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, the founder of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Boston Globe, and elsewhere. He is the author of a number of bestsellers. The most recent book is Irrationally Yours on Missing Socks, Pickup Lines, and Other Existential Puzzles. So I have to ask you, what is this about missing socks? Why do socks disappear in the wash?
Oh, so it turns out that there is a black hole specially designed for socks. No, it turns out it's a memory problem. So here's what happened. You do laundry and you find one sock. And you say to yourself, where's the partner? Where did it go away? And you forget about it. And then later on, you see the other sock, but you don't remember what's the sock you saw first. So it's basically a problem of double counting.
But Dan, that doesn't work for me. I actually put all of the single socks together in a part of my drawer, waiting for the other sock to show up. Some of them never show up.
So maybe that's only explains some of the mystery, and there seems more research to be done on this.
The book is published by Harper Perennial. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, as always.